The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian World Cup Football Daily, and it's well done to France and Kylian Mbappe, who finally wake up in this tournament. For Argentina, who've wandered about on the floor of it like a very tired wasp, it's probably for the best that they've been put out of their misery. In the late game, Uruguay and Edison Cavani see off Portugal in a game that was far less violent than we all hoped it would be. So Ronaldo finally ends the who's better debate by keeping his country at the World Cup for 4 hours longer than Lionel Messi. Also, we'll take a look at tomorrow's games, take your questions, and milk Barry for all he's worth on tonight's Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Kevin writes, what did Barry do on his night off?
Barry didn't have a day off yesterday.
You trooper, you are.
I had to go to Manchester and do a corporate event for The Guardian.
They send you to schmooze people.
Yes.
Was it successful?
It was very good fun, actually. I sort of interviewed Tom Jenkins in front of an audience of media types who were having a nice free lunch. And Tom gave some very interesting insights into his role as a sports photographer and specifically working at World Cups, which is very fascinating. We should get him on sometime.
Okay.
I was absolutely... And the whole crowd were riveted on hanging on his every word.
Marcela Moura y Araujo.
Hello.
Are you okay?
I am okay. I am, indeed. I'm more than okay, actually. Okay. I think I'm...
You're over the pain of this afternoon.
Yeah.
Okay. Philippe Auclair, bonjour.
Bonjour,
you can
Max.
Rub it in Marcela's face.
I wouldn't do such a thing. Anyway, Marcela and I are delighted to see Uruguay go through.
Okay. Well, we'll get on to Uruguay in a second. But France 4, Argentina 3. Quelle folie on the L'Equipe website, which means...
How crazy. What larks.
What did you make of the game, Philippe Auclair?
I made it that a very, very disappointing Argentinian team was put out of its misery, as you said, by a French team which, for the first time in this tournament, showed some of its potential and its capacities. With some superb individual performances from the French camp. Everybody will talk about Kylian Mbappé, but I thought Paul Pogba had a terrific game as well. N'Golo Kanté was superb in midfield. There were loads of reasons to be satisfied for Didier Deschamps. Perhaps the one that he might not be as satisfied with was the fact that I think 4-3 flatters Argentina. And I think France could have put quite a few more past a team that I didn't recognize as being Argentina, to be honest. So disappointing and so pedestrian, so ponderous, which is a word I use often, I know. But there was really not much to beat. And I think we're still all asking ourselves question, how it is possible to put that team on the pitch as well with Lionel Messi as a really false nine. But France took advantage of it. And showed, you know, why they are very dangerous on the counter and why they can go into the quarterfinals. Further than that, I don't know. I think it would be a very different proposition against Uruguay now.
Marcela, did you go into this game with any optimism? Because Argentina have, you know, they've stunk the place out, haven't they, really? I don't want to be rude about it, but they haven't been great. Did you think, oh, this could be different today?
I think we all did, right up until the last minute. I think if that last ball had gone in, it would have been epic.
It would have been, but you wouldn't have deserved it.
Well, I don't know about this deserved concept. It's so unusual to me. I think Argentina clearly, and we've known it for a long time, even way before the World Cup started, Argentina has some problems. Argentinian football has some problems. The main one being that it's stopped producing young talent. So we used to have a kind of tradition of these creative midfielders, to give you but one example. When Riquelme left Boca, Gago stepped in. When Gago left Boca, Ever Banega stepped in. When Banega left, we've got a void. Now, Banega represents the absolute last top flight generation of youth players that we had, and I think today we have a few young people that this World Cup will be a very good test for them. They'll be back. And we have a generation, a golden generation, a generation of absolute top of the draw elite players who today bowed out, I think. I don't know if Messi necessarily will. That's the kind of question everyone's saying, is this Messi's last World Cup? I don't know. Definitely Mascherano's, possibly Di Maria's. And they didn't have a dismal, what was that lovely word you used that I'm not familiar with?
Ponderous.
Ponderous.
Well, it was ponderous. It was ponderous.
I think they had moments slow. Where they were okay. They're slow. There's a kind of cartoon-like moment of Mascherano trying to keep up with the French youth. And to me, it wasn't really disappointing. I think if the last we'd seen of this generation of Argentinian players had been the game against Croatia, a really, really terrible blow to the national psyche, to the expectations, to whatever it is we're all hoping these kids are going to do for us. I mean, to me, they have left with dignity. If that last ball had gone in, it would have been dignified epic. It didn't. We have the dignity, not the epic.
I want to get an objective viewpoint. Barry, have Argentina left with dignity?
A bit. I mean, the way they constantly harass referees has been very unedifying. There's not much dignity there. But I don't think they played as badly as you and Philippe are making out today. Thought they had one 10-minute period, maybe 15, where they were dire. But apart from that, I thought they bossed parts of the game. And Messi was played, they didn't have him in the right place. I mean, Higuain and Aguero were on the bench. Messi was playing far too forward. There was no one to give him the ball. So that was a tactic, whoever's tactic it was, it misfired. But, you know, they lost by the odd goal of 7, and I don't think we saw the same match.
Well, I think it's one of those games where the quality of some of the goals, I mean, certainly Di Maria's goal was absolutely extraordinary, and Benjamin Pavard was tremendous. And also the quality of the performance of Mbappe, who was simply unstoppable at times, could make us forget about the fact that a lot of the play was quite mediocre. I'm sorry, I'm you know, I don't want to be the party.
No, but I'm not saying exciting. Argentina
it was exciting and so forth. But if you compare in terms of the level, the quality of the football, the second game of the day was light years ahead in terms of intensity, in terms of matching teams which had actually some, I don't know, proposed something in terms of play. I still don't know how France is playing. I know we have got fantastic players. I know we've got great potential. I still don't quite know how we're playing. And we didn't have today. We did it. Okay. But we didn't have a kind of a position that will show the limitations of that particular squad, I think.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Maybe I'm very, very severe.
I don't think you are. I mean, Argentina didn't do anything until Di Maria scored that amazing goal. Then they got a lucky deflection for the second goal to put them 2-1 up. And then they scored in the 95th minute. That aside, I just saw them being completely overwhelmed by the speed and the pace of Mbappe. And as you say, Pogba had a great game.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we did. maybe we just saw it.
I'm not saying they were good. I just don't think they were as bad as you're making out. And of course, they have problems. Their defence is awful, you know. Front end Ferrari, rear end clown car, you know. But I don't think they're as bad as people. I think there's this narrative, World Cup narrative, that Argentina are awful. And yeah, they haven't been good, but I don't think they were that bad in this game.
There's another narrative.
And like I say, there were 7 goals of the game. They got 3 of them.
Sure.
I think it was a cracking game of football. I'm sorry if you're disappointed with the quality side, but it was just it's funny because absolutely riveting.
I actually think it was a much better game than the second game we saw. So I agree with you, Philippe, but I also disagree with you. Another narrative has been about who's actually picking this team. Do we know who's managing this team? Is it Mascherano? Is it Sampaoli? Is it Messi?
I don't think it's Messi, because if it was Messi, Messi wouldn't have been playing where Messi played today.
If it was Mascherano, he would have taken himself off, you presume.
What puzzles me is if Sampaoli has no respect among his players and they don't listen to much of what he says, and that seems to be clear, why wasn't there just like a total mutiny? Why didn't they just play how they wanted to play today and disregard his instructions completely? Maybe they did. It just wasn't
maybe Messi's
enough.
Wanted to play in this position his whole career. Marcella, can you shed any light on that?
Well, I don't know exactly what goes on inside the headquarters of Team Argentina. I think the whole mutiny, coup d'etat, aborted coup, kind of language that's peppered this few games that Argentina have played is wildly exaggerated. I don't think the players in Sampaoli have a bad relationship at all. There may be some disagreements, but I completely believe the older players who say and have said, we are incredibly experienced at international level. We have got to 3 finals together. We know what it takes. We know what makes us comfortable. We know how unfit we are. We know how old we are. And aware of the weaknesses of the team, I think after that Croatia game, when Sampaoli did impose his will and say, I like 3 at the back and a very offensive team, they were all uncomfortable. They had a talk, but they also look in every good elite player and team does that. You know, they talk managers and players. And I think the press, especially the Argentinian press around them, has been incredibly avid to generate this constant need to generate the idea that there are coups and mutinies going on, and that they want to, that the head of the Football Association is going to be toppled, that Sampaoli was going to be sacked. I do hope there is some renewal now now that they're out, because really there needs to be. But I don't think Messi would play as a false 9, whatever that may mean. I'm sure you can all explain it to me, if he didn't want to in a game like this. And for the last couple of days, the talk has been entirely about when Guardiola tried to do that and how. So I suspect it is a discuss thing. And the thing I heard yesterday is that there's been opinion polls conducted in Argentina. Who do people believe should pick the team? Sampaoli, or rather, without names, the manager, the players, all together. And something like close to 80% think all together.
Interestingly, only Costa Rica had an older squad at this World Cup. Philippe, on the other side, is Didier Deschamps getting it right now? Jittery Zeitgeist says, is Philippe going to forgive Deschamps if France win the World Cup?
I'm not sure about that. No, I mean, the hope is that if you're talking about narratives, stories, whatever, the hope is that it is more a 1998 than a 2006 moment. 1998, Aimé Jacquet, the team at the beginning is not very popular, not playing very well. Gets out of its an easy group, then struggles and fights all the way to the final, and then the combination, the apotheosis. 2006, absolutely awful in the group phase. The players take over, go all the way to the final, should have won if it hadn't been for what, you know, what happened with Materazzi and Zidane. And when it was Dominic, whose magnificent record Didier Deschamps beat today by managing his 80th game at the top of France. So does he know what he's doing? He knows he's got a system in place, yes. He has an idea of how he wants it to function. Today we saw more of it. It's not a team that presses hard, as you saw against Argentina. They back off. What they do is that they're very quick to strike on the counter. And from time to time, 2-3 times a game, you will have those movements involving 3-4 players, which will be quite spectacular, including the one which started with Lloris today, which was really the best move of the game. Actually, one of the best moves of the World Cup. So maybe I'm a bit too tough on France. But on the other hand, I genuinely don't think that the right questions were asked of them. Genuinely don't think so.
7 goals, Barry. What was your favourite one?
Ooh, God. Angel Di Maria's.
Yeah, over Pavard's?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, they were all both good goals.
Because there's been a big debate is Pavard's goal better than Nacho's? outside of the right foot.
I don't understand why people need to have these debates. They're both really good goals. Could we not just leave it at that?
We can, yeah, absolutely.
The one thing against Pavard's goal, if you're looking at that, is the fact it doesn't hit the post, because it's sweeter when it hits the post.
I agree with you.
So actually, one thing, we saw a lot of goal celebrations today with substitutes getting involved, not for the first time. That's a big Tom Jenkins bugbear, sports photographer bugbear. They don't want subs with their
high-vis
ruining their photos.
I understand that. Question for you, Marcella. Will this be Messi's final World Cup?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. I mean, there's no reason why it should be. And in many ways, it's really surprising that he was there at all, given that he was so adamant that he'd had enough 2 years ago when they lost the final of the fake Copa America or the centenary Copa America. There's no reason why it should be. I don't know what's going to happen to Argentinian football next. I mean, in the inevitable reshuffle that might ensue, some terrible people could end up in control of football. And I hope Messi steps back and just continues to delight. I mean, he did leave us with goal number 100 this World Cup. And to me, that's perfect if he stops at that. But people play when they're 34, 35 years old. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, it's interesting, Barry, isn't it? Because you wonder what type of player Messi will become when he gets older, because he can't just go and sit in front of the back four, can he? Just play sideways passes, can he?
I don't know. I'd just like to ask Marcella, two questions. A, is there not like sort of an Argentinian Tony Pulis or Sam Allardyce that can just go in and whip that defence into shape and make them impenetrable the way Big Sam and Pulis do when they move to a new club? And will Messi be blamed for this failure at home, or is Sampaoli the scapegoat this time?
Well, I think already there's been a lot of see what I mean about Messi doing the rounds. I don't think he'll be blamed as badly as he would have been 2 games ago. But there is, I really believe there's a division in the kind of collective psyche or whatever, the national discourse, where some people just don't like Messi. They don't think he's Maradona enough. They don't think he's Argentinian enough. They don't think he's showed up. And today he didn't show up. And some people were saying, well, why didn't Sampaoli play Messi then today? Why isn't Messi playing? So that discourse is there. And then the discourse that is like, it's fine, he's Argentinian and he's great and he's been good enough is also there. So who knows? Sampaoli's not popular at all. He's not as unpopular as the press and the directors of the Football Association, quoting same opinion polls. So Messi's not unpopular at all in statistical terms, but the criticisms are loud. He didn't turn up for Argentina. And Sampaoli, midway down, football journalists and way, way down, and the kind of powers that be in the Football Association, very, very unpopular. About the defence, I don't think we do have a character like that. We do have Ruggieri, who was a defender in 1986, who is very vociferous and has been agitating public opinion a lot in the past few days. He's the main exponent of the argument that these players lack balls and that they should just beat each other up in the dressing room like they all did in 86 and get over themselves and go out and do some proper kind of punchy defensive football. And I think possibly his discourse is what inspired, if you like, Valdano's riposte that you like so much. I think there is a kind of, to put it very, very bluntly, balls against the ball argument going on. And Ruggieri hasn't ever inspired a generation of great defenders. We've had great goalkeepers who've been in charge of goalkeeper training at national level. And again, you know, that's, I don't know how you do it. And I suspect there's an incredible tradition of child and adolescent development that has lasted for the best part of last century, with professionals who are teachers, essentially, committed to training kids and not seeing it as a stepping stone to then go and manage the adults. And for the last 10, 15 years, I would say, those people have been completely sucked dry, no resources, no help, no new people to come along. And that's when the football started to crumble, because I think that you need natural talent and good education to get proper professional training. So hopefully someone like Mascherano will take on training, grooming young defenders.
I mean, why do they need an Argentinian Sam Allardyce when they could just get Sam Allardyce?
Well, yes.
Anyway, that means that both finalists from the 2014 World Cup have gone out. England are going to win it. That also means that France... Yes, Philippe?
No, just to mention, Pavard's goal.
Yeah.
It's only the third goal of his professional career.
Really?
He only scored twice before. Which is pretty
He'll never hit a football that sweetly again, will he?
No, it's never going to happen. I mean, it's a bit like Roberto Carlos, only scored one free kick like that. All the others finished in row Z. And
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter, because it will always be remembered for that wonderful half volley.
So France will play Uruguay, and in part two, we will discuss their victory over Portugal. Welcome to part two of the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. There's a live show on July the 12th at the Emmanuel Centre in London, featuring one Barry Glendening, one Philippe Auclair, one Ellis James, and me. It could be ahead of the England-France World Cup final.
Indeed,
Yep. So come along and watch us both be... I'll be very overexcited that we're going to win, and you'll be convinced you're going to lose, and we all know that you'll beat us. Anyway, Uruguay 2, Portugal 1. I was really hoping for a bloodbath. Buckets of red cards, huge amounts of VAR. The first card, Barry, was in the 94th minute, shown to Ronaldo for joining a merry band of Portuguese shoving their head in the ref's face to say they should have had a free kick. Did you enjoy the match?
I did. It kind of made fools of us all, because the general pre-match consensus seemed to be that this would be a dour, attritional game of two teams reluctant to attack, and what we got was anything but, and thoroughly enjoyable, some fine goals. Edison Cavani's in particular were both wonderful goals, and I think Uruguay were worthy winners.
Mm. They defend so brilliantly, Philippe, don't they, Uruguay?
Yes, apart on the occasion that the unmentionable put in the Uruguayan net. I can't even bring myself to say that.
Say Pepe.
It's Pepe.
It's cathartic to say.
It's cathartic, but it's the one occasion which Godin, went to Ronaldo and took advantage of that. No, it's also the way perhaps I love that. I absolutely love that game, and perhaps because I was also following Edinson Cavani all through the game, really looking at him closely, and what he did today was simply magnificent. The way he the way he faced the ball in, he didn't headed it, and he faced it.
Danny says, "Is that the best goal ever scored by a face?"
Yeah, probably, probably. And the second one was a sublime strike. But it's also the way he defended, and the way he was this extra. As in a 4-4-2, you always need one of your two strikers to do the dirty work. Well, not the dirty work, the noble work.
So when you got Suarez next to you.
And Cavani did that absolutely magnificently. And I love the way they're organized. I love to see the way they defend. As if we were talking about it, as if there's a piece of string or an elastic band which is between all these players, and the way they move together is beautiful to watch. And also thought Portugal gave an awful lot of that game. They showed an awful... Bernardo Silva had his best game of the competition, for example. It was absolutely terrific. High tempo, high intensity, and technically very, very good indeed.
He had a big chance.
I would argue that face from the A-team was a quite prolific scorer and regularly punched above his weight.
I think it's a very good point. Who did you want to be out of the four?
Hannibal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I sort of fancied being Murdoch, really. Marcella?
Yeah.
Out of the four, who did you want to be?
I'm happy being me.
Okay. Yeah. I'll ask you a question that you might have an idea what we're talking about. You had an interesting point to make when we were watching Uruguay about the secular nature of Uruguay, the country, and Edison Cavani being the antithesis of this.
Well, because there's a Uruguayan academic who's been writing a lot about the secular nature of Uruguay being, important. Which I think it is, actually. I think it's a sign of a progressive country, and they are very atheist and in things like education. I mean, I think they don't even call Christmas Day Christmas or Easter holidays Easter or something. But completely atheist.
PC,
a bit like France, they don't like religious emblems at schools, they're forgiven and so on. But I think I understand Edison Cavani is incredibly religious and dedicates his goals to Christ and so on. So I thought that was kind of paradoxical.
If Cavani scores a hat-trick to win Uruguay the World Cup, could he convert a nation?
Who knows? You know, the religious, the quasi-religious nature of football is so... strong. Anything could happen. I do think it's interesting, moving completely away from this God talk.
Sure.
But Uruguay, everything Argentina is not. And I've got a whole load of comments flooding in from Argentinians going, why can't we be more like them? See what I mean? That's proper defending. That's not giving up. That's being there all the time. And I'm delighted for them and delighted for the southern cone of South America that we've still got representatives at the World Cup stage. And I love your image of them being tied by a piece of string because they do understand each other and know where each other is on the pitch, which I think is exactly what Argentina couldn't crack this time
and
around.
Of course, they've got a manager who everybody would like to see to do very,
to do well,
very well. Indeed.
Very well.
We have to mention Tintin, though. Because we mentioned Tintin before.
We did, yes.
In the famous episode of Barry explaining to us what it felt like to have a player on your back. And I would encourage our listeners to check out a chap called Raskar Kapak, which is a character in a very famous Tintin adventure, and to make a comparison with Edinson Cavani.
Mm. They do look identical.
It's extraordinary.
I just didn't know how much you knew about Tintin.
A lot.
Okay. Like more than you know about football. If there was Tintin Weekly, would you be?
Well, yeah, if there was a mastermind, would it be my specialist subject, something like that?
It would be Tintin.
I don't know, perhaps. We bathe in Tintin in France. Well, you've bathed in Tintin too, probably yourself.
I'm more A-team than Tintin, I'll be honest.
Hey.
No, I grew up reading Tintin. Everything I know about international
politics.
I learned from
and
Tintin.
Everything. So having said that, Uruguay is probably the most religious country on earth, isn't it?
What would your specialist subject be, a mastermind, Max?
I'd say Neighbours in the 90s. Sort of the
Harold Bishop final lineups.
Actually, yeah. FA Cup final lineups of the late 80s, early 90s. Or Neighbours.
Niche.
Neighbours, the Harold Bishop years. We have to be one of those two. If Uruguay are attached by string in their defence, does the string have enough elasticity in it when Kylian Mbappe is running through them?
Very good question. I very much doubt that it will give Kylian Mbappe the chance to stretch his legs, as I believe is the expression, as much as he did against Argentina. They won't attack the same way. And I'm sure that Tabárez will have an anti-Mbappe plan.
Who do you fancy, Barry, in that one?
Uruguay.
Okay. I mean, do you fancy them to go further than that?
Yeah, I wouldn't. They're as impressive a team as I have seen in a competition in which not that many teams have impressed me. I would say them, Croatia and Spain are the best three left in it.
And England?
I may be doing France an injustice.
Mm.
But I haven't been impressed with France before today. So, and even at times today, I wasn't that impressed with them.
Jason says, on a scale of 1 to Jibril Cissé, where does Ronaldo's awful goatee rank? Around the Chris Armstrong area?
Cissé good? Like Cissé?
Well, apparently. GSV Vagrant says, how much are you enjoying Uruguay going full Sunday league by having an outfielder take goal kicks? I was very pleased about that. It's very rare that it happens. You were saying Inter back in the day.
Yeah, Inter back in the days of Helenio Herrera was using this as a tactic because they had a centre-half, whose name I forget, which is terrible, who was very good at distributing long balls, and they saw that as a means to create havoc in the opposition half without running any risk. So they used, it was their policy to use the centre-half to do that.
We're here to learn. Paul says, after just seeing Ronaldo's shorts pulled up so far... It's prompted TV watershed warnings.
It's like Fabian Barthez used to do that. Do you remember when he was unhappy? He used to go like this.
But I think Ronaldo's doing it to show. I mean, they are an exceptional pair of quads, aren't they? I mean, they're really magnificent. Paul says, it got me thinking, out of the Guardian Football Weekly team, past or present, who could squat the most weight in the gym?
Sean Ingle.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Okay, there you go. And Alao says, because we were expecting this game to be full of just filth. It didn't really transpire, but he asked the question, what's the pod's World Cup shithousery 11? He says Costa and Suarez leading the line, obviously. So that's fine. Costa and Suarez will lead the line. This is the team that we have come up with between us. Mm-hmm. Schumacher in goal, obviously, for...
1982, Patrick Battiston.
Yeah, arguably the worst... foul, arguably the worst assault on or off a football pitch. We're playing a back three of Pepe, Materazzi and Ramos. We don't need to go any further, do we? Fullbacks were trickier. We went Dani Alves. I wonder if that's a little harsh on Alves, no? I mean,
In terms of the rolling around and things like that, he's pretty good.
Okay. On the left, we've got Fabio Grosso. For our Australian listeners, Lucas Neal still shouldn't have gone to ground. Having said that, it was a terrible dive, and then they went on to win that one, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
Okay, Diego Simeone in holding midfield, flanked by Maradona and Rivaldo, with Suarez and Costa up front. I mean, it's a good team.
It would win the World Cup, no doubt.
Our bench, we have two substitutes, Elhaj Diouf, as requested personally by Barry, and Slaven.
Well, Elhaj Diouf didn't get in the team because he was good at the World Cup and only developed his powers of shithousery after he secured his big money move to the UK.
And Slaven Bilic for keeping Laurent Blanc out.
Mm-hmm.
But did that mean that Frank Leboeuf got a World Cup winner's medal?
That's correct.
And so Frank Leboeuf may never not have become the actor that he is had Bilic not got Laurent Blanc suspended.
That's very true.
So, you know, you give with one hand and you take with the other. Don't you? So there's our shithousery 11. Feel free to add to it below the line. And that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll look ahead to tomorrow's games. Welcome to part three of the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Let's look ahead to tomorrow's games. The host, Russia, plays Spain. Let's talk to Elliot Rothwell, a journalist based in Moscow, for a Russian perspective. Elliot, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Is there still huge optimism around this Russian team, or did that defeat in the last group game against Uruguay sort of temper that slightly?
I think it was a reality check to some extent again against Uruguay. I don't think Russia really were in the game for too many parts. I think Uruguay looked comfortable. Obviously, they've not conceded a goal in the tournament yet, and Russia didn't really get that close to scoring. But Artem Zuba, the striker, the Russian, the kind of big man up front, he said today that this is the game of our lives. We need to play every single play. We need to play 200-300% of their usual kind of capacity. So they know that they're up against it against Spain, but they've been harking back to the game in Euro 2008 against the Netherlands when everybody thought that they were going to crash out, and that was the game where the famous Andrei Arshavin celebration, and they eventually went through to the semi-finals. But they're hoping for another kind of miracle, and really some of them I think have been quite heartened by what they've seen from Spain. You know, that Spain have obviously got fantastic midfielders, fantastic attacking players. But the defence looks like it can be got at. It looks like Russia will have an opportunity to score a goal. So if they can do that, and if they can kind of put Spain under pressure, obviously they'll have the full weight of the crowd will be behind Russia largely, then really anything can happen in kind of a knockout game.
After the first two games, a lot of people made some jokes about the fact that the Russians had run more than any other team and had questioned exactly what they'd done to make them run so far. I presume any of those insinuations weren't heard over in Russia.
Yeah, not particularly. It wasn't reported on here. They didn't even really make much of a deal about the fact that they were the highest kind of running team, covered the most kilometres per game. I think a few people who cottoned onto it were kind of looked at it as like the bitter West kind of, well, you said all the time before the tournament, you said we had a rubbish team, and now that we've got a good team, all you can say is, well, maybe actually you're using something to help you run. But they obviously don't take too kindly to that. But given the kind of history of the recent history of Russian sport and Russian state doping programs, it's obviously notable that they were the highest kind of running team. And some people found it quite funny. Some other people found it quite sinister, I think. But I guess if there was anything untoward, which there's no indication that there is at the moment, if that will become apparent in the fullness of time.
Alexander Golovin looks set to join Chelsea, but apparently not his first choice. He would have preferred to go to Barcelona.
Yeah, wouldn't we all?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, exactly. I'd have a nice time on the beach in Barcelona playing with Lionel Messi. He's a very good player. So I've spent quite a lot of time at CSKA in the last season where he played, and he's fantastic. I think we saw that in the first two games of the World Cup as well. He's a kind of what they call in Russian a universal player, kind of the very modern player who plays all parts of the game. He's a very kind of total football type player. You could play him really anywhere across the field, and even probably as a false nine. He's very technically good. He's very fast. He's takes great free kicks, takes great corners. He really has got a lot, and he would fit in really in the kind of Barcelona mold. If everything goes right in his career, you can see him kind of morphing into an Iniesta type player. Maybe not at the same level as Iniesta, because very few players ever reach that level, but in that type of player, he's got that type of qualities. But I think the Chelsea thing comes about because he was originally linked to Arsenal, but that didn't come off. It looks like they're going for Lucas Torreira, the Uruguay centre midfielder, instead. And then Juventus, but Juventus didn't want to pay the money, which is kind of classic Juventus transfer strategy. They sell big players for big money and sign players for not particularly big money. And then Chelsea, Roman Abramovich has a really good relationship with the board at CSK and the leader of CSK, and I think they negotiated the price up. I think it's going to be something around 30, 35 million euros, so they'll be quite happy with that. The issue is that is Golovin going to play at Chelsea? Is he going to be left on the bench? There was a bit of talk in Russia that he will be farmed out alone to Vitesse, which would kind of, the story fits quite perfectly, but whether it will actually happen, because the manager of Vitesse now is Leonid Kutsky, who was the guy who brought Golovin through at CSKA. Obviously the ex-Hull manager, and he's out of the test. The test had this link with Chelsea where lots of players go out on loan there, but to spend kind of 30 million on Russia's brightest prospect since Andrei Shevin, and then to just send him on loan to the test does seem quite incongruous. But where he'll play at Chelsea, I don't know. Whoever the manager is going to be, probably Maurizio Sarri. If he's going to play 4-2-3-1, Golovin could play as the main playmaker. Where that leaves other players in the squad, I'm not sure how he fits in. Eden Hazard will be interesting to see, but he is a player who can make an impact in at any level of football. I think it's just whether he gets the minutes at Chelsea.
Give us a score prediction, Elliot.
Oh dear, I'm going to say 2-1 to Spain in extra time.
All right, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Elliot Rothwell there, football journalist based out in Moscow. That's given us the sort of Russian perspective. Spain so far, Barry, have at times looked wonderful, yet only won one of their group games.
Yeah, they've looked very impressive in a game they didn't win. Didn't look particularly impressive at all in the game they did. And I'm not sure what to make of that. I think they're eminently beatable, but I'm not sure if Russia are good enough to beat them. So, yeah, it's a tough one to call.
Have you been impressed with Spain so far, Philippe?
Like Barry, I was impressed in the first game against Portugal for quite a while. Because we shouldn't forget as well that Portugal were not exactly unlucky in drawing that particular game. And Isco has certainly been one of the players of the tournament so far. But quite a few have been underperforming. And I found them as well, I've said that for so many teams, a bit laboured at times. Perhaps not as quick in, you know, passing the ball to each other as they can do. So I'm sitting on the fence here. I genuinely don't think that Russia is strong enough to trouble them too much. But I'm wondering if what people were saying before the tournament is actually, which I kind of agreed with, is something that I would still agree with now. I don't know. They're not quite at the level I was expecting them to be, which is sometimes a very good thing to be in the group phase. I mean, one of the best group phases that Spain ever had in a World Cup was 2006, wasn't it? Where they were absolutely fantastic and they got beaten in the round of 16.
So, but they've conceded 5 goals in 3 games, you know. Their goalkeeper, there was talk he might be dropped. I don't think he's going to be dropped. Yeah. David Silva, I think, is under pressure as well. Although I think he gave the press conference today with alongside the manager, which would suggest he, or the standing manager, which would suggest he will probably play. But yeah, I don't think Russia quite have enough to beat them. I see Denis Cherisov actually has had to come out and deny allegations that he was injected with growth hormones. allegations made by his own father.
Really?
Who's a former Russian footballer. But I don't think...
Cheers, Dad.
Yeah, isn't it? Nice one. His dad, yeah, said this in an interview. I mean, it's going back a bit, a year, I think, or something. But it's being claimed that his father's comments, I think, were lost in translation or something.
Okay. On to Croatia versus Denmark then. Let's get the Danish perspective from Troels Henriksen from Jyllandsposten out in Nizhny Novgorod. Troels, how are you?
Yes, hello. I'm fine.
First of all, you had to watch the Denmark-France game. Have you woken up?
Yeah, I have. But, you know, for us Danes, it was pretty exciting anyway because... Yeah, you never know. But of course, I was sitting in the stands and I knew that Peru was up 2-0. So that took a bit of off the excitement. But every time you watch a group day, game at the World Cup, when you're from a country with 5 million inhabitants, it's just pretty exciting. So I was not about to fall asleep.
Croatia, everyone seems to be tipping them to go a long way in this tournament. How optimistic are you?
Well, I'm actually pretty optimistic, and I think the Danish team is as well. I've been with them in Anapa, down by the Black Sea, and I'm sensing a positive atmosphere. They're very self-confident about being able to make this a very tight game. And I believe that they will. Denmark is built like a very good tournament team with a good goalkeeper and a very good defense. And well, if they can get Christian Eriksen in closer to the goal with the ball, I think they have a chance.
Denmark have at times struggled to get Christian Eriksen on the ball, which must be a bit of a concern as he is obviously your star player.
That's right. I've been watching some statistics from the group stage here, and it's not overwhelming how much he's been a part of the game, how many key passes he's tried, and so forth. I think one of the reasons is that they were very surprised in the first game against Peru about the quality from the team from Peru, who probably was the best of the four teams in that group. Against Australia, well, he made a goal, and then like the last hour of the game was just disappointing from Denmark. And then there was the France game, that it was just a weird game because, well, we could also see today what happens when you try to attack France and when you try to push up your defense close to the midfield. they're going to punish you with their pace and the ability to make the counterattacks. So that was just a very clever tactical performance from Denmark, and it was, of course, very, very difficult for him in that game. But I'm sure they've been talking about this all week. They want to take their chances against Croatia and try to attack them when they've got that opportunity, and that should give Christian Eriksen some more chances for setting up the other players and being dangerous himself.
Having Yusuf Poulsen back from suspension must be quite a big lift as well, because he's had a very eventful World Cup, to say the least.
Yes, he has. We of course, in Denmark, we hope that he won't make another penalty. But he's very important in several ways. He's one of the players on the team that runs the most. He seems to never get tired. He's also found a way to score a bit of goals, being dangerous himself. So he's strong. He's tall. So that also gives them some strength in the set pieces, both their own and when they're about to defend Croatia. So that's good for the team.
And also, you're in the easy side of the draw, aren't you? You have to play Croatia, then you've got Spain, then England, and then you're in the World Cup final.
Yeah, well, we're not in a position where. Well, as a Danish team, I'm saying we. The Danish team is not in a position where they're entitled to look very much forward in a tournament like this.
Neither are England trolls, but it hasn't stopped them.
Well, you're a bigger football nation, but they just think about Croatia. I don't know. I remember in 2004, the Euros there, they were also in the good side of the tournament. They were meeting the Czech Republic after they won the group, and then if they won that game, they had Greece in the semifinal, and then they were in the final. But then they lost 3-0 to Czech Republic. So that's what happens when you try to do something like that, I think.
Look, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks so much for talking to us. Troels Henriksen there from Ulensposten out in Russia. We expect Croatia to win this, don't we, Philippe? I mean, Troels was very, very sort of optimistic and feels like I sort of feel about England, I think. But really, Croatia have looked very strong.
They have looked stronger than they have in previous tournaments. Though you would always think of Croatia as being the type of team, and actually a team which has tended to crumble in games where everything depended on what was happening on this single game. But on the other hand, yes, they've been very impressive. They seem to be growing in the tournament. They looked really extremely secure as well in the last outing. So, yeah, you see them as... I don't know if they're as good as the team that was third, you know, in 98. But perhaps this could be Croatia's finest hour since then. And you would have to say it's not what we saw from Denmark in the group phase that would convince you that they can go a long way. I mean, remember, their games were actually quite poor. They should never have won against Peru, for example. And against France, we saw absolutely nothing. So, well done for being there, but I think we're all expecting Croatia to be there in the quarters. And this will bite us on the arse, no doubt.
Us the French or us the world?
No, I mean, I don't know. I'm still at this point where I'm not convinced by anybody. So there's a certain frailty in this Croatian side as well. Maybe the Danes can exploit it. I don't know. What do you think, Max?
I think Croatia look wonderful, and I love Luka Modric. I would watch him. I'd just watch him run around a park with a ball.
Yeah.
If there was no opposition. So I hope they win. But
would he be kicking the ball or would it be under his arm?
I don't really mind. I mean, obviously, to sort of paraphrase the Barney Ronay quote, I would definitely watch Luka Modric dressed as a witch running around a park with a broomstick and a hat on. In slightly more sort of savoury news, Iranian striker Sardar Azmoun has announced his retirement from international football at the age of just 23, citing the effects of stress of criticism on his mother. He said, "My mother had overcome a serious illness. I was happy. Unfortunately, because of the unkindness of some people and the insults that me and my teammates in no way deserved, her illness has become severe. This has put me in a difficult position where I must pick one or the other. And as a result, I picked my mother." She's very sad at 23. And Philippe, I presume this is all social media and social media.
Yeah, no, that's the problem, is that he is by far the most followed Asian player on social networks, particularly in Instagram. He's a massive, massive star. And people were expecting an awful lot of him. There were all these things about him being the Iranian Messi, even though his game has got nothing to do with Messi's game. So much pressure, and obviously he just cannot handle it. And, you know, very, as you say, very, very sad. But a fruit, a consequence of his fame and of the fact that he represents something which is quite unique in Iranian football, certainly in terms of with the youth of his own country.
Because we've seen that with the Jimmy Durmaz thing as well in Sweden, haven't we? I mean, he's not retired, but I mean, what do you do about social media? It's there.
Ignore it.
I mean, that's why. I just retweet it, but you know, It's never quite as vicious.
I suppose some people are more sensitive to this kind of thing than others, but. You know, you don't want to let the idiots grind you down.
Well, there's a very big difference between what happened to Mishi Batshuayi, which he actually batted back with quite beautifully, but which was basically bants, even if not always, you know, it was bants. This is not bants, or this is, we're talking about threats. We're talking about people being more than trolls. Mm. I mean, quasi-criminal as far as I'm concerned.
It actually precedes social media, though. I mean, there's been cases for a long time of players whose mothers can't handle the pressure. And I think it's what makes people like Tabárez or Pekerman or, you know, people who could put this whole thing in perspective so important. Because I do think they're very young players. They become ridiculously either idolised or just things are expected of them that it's impossible to expect of a single human being. And it's very, very sad and wrong. But as Philippe says, when it starts to border on the criminal, it's not very easy to just outlaw it. And I think social media enhances the phenomena, but it's as old as football itself.
Apparently Twitter has been extremely quick at suspending accounts of people who show clips of the World Cup.
Oh, yeah.
But are much slower at suspending the accounts of people who are basically threatening people with horrible things. There you go.
Some pictures from Shaimar Khalil of the BBC. Mo Salah's home address was leaked on Facebook. Crowds gathering outside his house. What does he do? He just went outside and just signed autographs, which he shouldn't have to do, but seems to be the right thing to do. Which is obviously what you do, Barry, when people...
Yeah, when my home address is leaked on Facebook. I see as well.
I wonder if we gave out your home address on the pod. Do you reckon tomorrow there'd be crowds of people? Do you think it'd be one person?
No.
Okay. Should we try?
No.
Okay. On the day off of the World Cup, Manda on Twitter said, "No World Cup today. What did you do on the day off?" People were writing those articles about one day without football. How will we cope? And Manda wrote, "I'll have to settle for Lincoln Red Imps versus Dritter in the Champions League preliminary round. Extraordinary game. Dritter of Kosovo won 4-1 after extra time, opening the scoring after 2 minutes. The Lincoln Red Imps equalised after an hour. In extra time, there were 2 red cards, a penalty, 3 goals, 2 of them coming in injury time of extra time. Dritter's starting 11 received 9 yellows and a red." It's really the Champions League overshadowing the World Cup.
Completely.
Already, isn't it? Ben Dudley writes, "The Dutch second division has been renamed the Kuiken Kampioen, meaning the winner will be the Kampioen Kuiken Kampioen, which is KKK for short." So they haven't really thought that one through. Kuiken. Daniel, on me not trusting keepers in short sleeves.
Oh, Max.
Oh, dear.
Not the only one to suggest this. "I can't think of a keeper in short sleeves that I would bet my house on," was my quote. He has replied saying Gigi Buffon and Iker Casillas are two that instantly spring to mind. I think that's fair enough. But Christopher says, your theory on goalkeepers is right. I play in an over-40s league in the suburbs of Chicago and wear short sleeves due to the heat, and I'm dodgy as hell between the posts. This is from Bankhead. Listening to a previous pod with a friend here in the US, when Max told Barry, you're just here for the crack, my friend seemed to think he was referring to crack cocaine. When Barry then burst into a manic song, basically the word Bagora over and over and over, he felt his suspicions were affirmed. What does crack mean in this context? I assume it means excitement.
Fun.
Fun and excitement. But I can see how he put two and two together and got five there. Barry for president writes, I really enjoy Barry's daily read. Keep it going. Barry 2018, making the World Cup great again. Connor says, will there be a compilation released of all Barry's song readings at the end of the tournament? Easily the highlight of the World Cup. Barry, will there be?
Almost certainly not.
Although somebody did put you in a Craig David bubble hat on Twitter and put the Craig David music
I've seen the picture. I haven't heard the tune.
Oh, yeah. It looks wonderful. Stephen once again has asked the littlest hobo. See what we can do. Matt says, can Barry please do the chorus to I'm Sorry, Miss Jackson by Outkast? But since, Marcella, you're here, Mark says, as Marcella also possesses a rather unique and attractive voice and lilt, shouldn't she read together with Barry? I suggest the lyrics of I've Had the Time of My Life. I believe it's from the movie Dirty Dancing.
Jesus, you have to pay double to get Barry and me doing the sequel of Dirty Dancing.
You don't have to do the lift and the jump. May I point out? God. At no point. Anyway, Philippe, I don't know if this will work, but I don't mind. Lovely to have you.
Lovely to have you back.
See you again soon. We leave you with the...
Can't I read beautiful Uruguayan poems dedicated to Maradona instead?
We leave you with the debut single of Barry Glendenning and Marcela Mora y Araujo. This is I've Had the Time of My Life.
Now I've had the time of my life. No, I've never felt like this before. Yes, I swear it's the truth. And I owe it all to you.
Because I've had the time of my life and I owe it all to you.
I've been waiting for so long, now I finally found someone to stand by me.
We saw the writing on the wall as we felt this magical fantasy.
Now with passion in our eyes, there's no way we could disguise it secretly. So we take each other's hand because we seem to understand the urgency. Just remember,
you're the one thing
I can't get enough of.
So I'll tell you something.
This could be love, because I've had the time of my life. No, I've never felt this way before. Yes, I swear it's the truth, and I owe it all to you.
With my body and soul, I want you more than you'll ever know.
So we'll just let it go. Don't be afraid to lose control.
Yes, I know what's on your mind when you say, stay with me tonight.
Just remember, you're the one thing
I can't get enough of.
So I'll tell you something.
This could be love. Because
I had the time of my life. And I've searched through every open door. Till I found the truth. And I owe it all to you. Now I've had the time of my life. No, I've never felt this way before.
Never felt this way.
Yes, I swear it's the truth, and I owe it all to you. Cause I had the time of my life, and I've searched through every open door till I found the truth, and I owe it all to you.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.